Good morning, everyone. We have five arguments on today's schedule. We'll begin with appeal number 22-1116, Gail Stockton versus Milwaukee County, its Department of Corrections. And Mr. Sergeant, good morning.
May it please the court, your honors. The lower court made three legal errors in this case that I'd like to focus on this morning. First, the lower court applied the wrong legal standard to the plaintiff's Monell claims. Second, the lower court erred in requiring the plaintiff to present direct evidence as to nurse practitioner Mercy Mahaga's knowledge concerning the serious risk of infective endocarditis to Michael Madden, rather than allowing the plaintiff to proceed by presenting circumstantial evidence as to her state of mind consistent with this court's precedent. Third, the lower court committed a legal error when it determined that Madden's right to be free of excessive force as he was actively dying was not clearly established at the times at issue in this case. Turning to the first point, Your Honor, the court was wrong in dismissing the plaintiff's Monell claims on the basis that there was no underlying constitutional violation.
Don't you have a problem with Dean in this case, with Dean versus Wexford?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
What other sort of comparators do you have? Where has this happened before?
In terms of the Dean case, Your Honor, with respect to which issue? I apologize, Your Honor.
The Monell issue.
Yeah, so
you can't have it just happen to one person and then establish a policy with moving force causation. I think that's what Dean establishes, and it seems similar to Dean to me.
Yeah, well, in Thomas versus Cook County Sheriff's Department, Your Honor, this court specifically held that a finding of individual employee or officer liability is not necessary in order to establish a Monell claim. In this context, all the plaintiff needs to do is present evidence that there was some municipal custom or practice that led to the inmate's injury. In terms of the evidence that's necessary, the recent Howell case that this court decided just last year acknowledges that there is no bright-line rule regarding the quantity, the quality, or the frequency of contact.
Mr. Sergeck, I think what Judge Kirsch is getting at, because we were on the Dean panel together,
yes,
is if you are not relying on individual liability for any of the defendants here for your Monell claim, if instead you're arguing there's a widespread policy, and that widespread policy, separate and apart from any of the conduct of the individual defendants here, that widespread policy was the moving force behind a constitutional violation involving your client, that it's not sufficient to have just the single incident of your client in order to show Monell liability under a widespread practice. You need to show that the underlying conduct, the underlying widespread practice, caused these constitutional violations for others. So what's the evidence, other than what you've argued with respect to the plaintiff here, what is the evidence of others? Do you understand the question?
Yes, I understand. In terms of whether there are other injuries or other deaths that are relatable to the widespread practices, this is not a case where there's any, in our view, question as to whether the widespread practices existed or not. Now,
but it's more. It has to be more than there's a widespread practice. You have to show that these widespread practices resulted in other constitutional violations.
Yes. Well, I don't think that the law goes that far, Your Honor. In terms of the widespread practices,
that's what Dean said.
Well, hold on. Sorry, Judge.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
So here's what. Let me try it from a different angle. It's the same question. There's no question in my mind that there are serious issues with the provision of health care at the facility. No doubt about it at all. You point to the consent decree. Indeed, there's a monitor in place. How do you link the issues that gave rise to the consent decree, all those deficiencies, to this case?
Yeah.
That's the linkage that I don't see.
Okay.
And you seem to be arguing it at a level of generality higher than the law would permit. I think that's Judge St. Eve's moving force point. In other words, you say, I don't remember the name of these things, but sick call tickets or medical call tickets or something.
Sick call slips, Your Honor.
Sick call slips. Okay. And then this gentleman suffered from, you know, heart issues, and there's been cardiac care issues at the facility. That's at too high of a level of generality, in my view. What's your response to that?
I would disagree, Your Honor. In terms of the specific widespread practices that the plaintiffs are pointing to, there's no question that there was understaffing going on at the Milwaukee County Jail during the entire period of
time. No doubt about it, but I agree with that. But that's up here. So how did the understaffing manifest itself as to Mr. Madden?
This is the plaintiff's expert witness, and we did a thorough review of the data to establish how the understaffing with respect to nurse practitioners specifically impacted Michael Madden. With respect to this, the sick call slip that was entered into the electronic medical record on October 25th, that was lost, and we don't know when it was even completed.
That's the one that referred to allergies, not to heart issues.
Well, it referred to bad symptoms, Your Honor. Now,
from
Mr. Madden,
allergies.
Well, he wasn't able to diagnose himself, and I don't think that there is anything that requires him to do that. The point on it,
but if
allergies is a lot different than a heart problem.
And if you're trying to say that sick call slip was the motivating factor here, it seems like a big leap to say a sick call slip talking about allergies was a motivating factor for a death involving heart issues.
Well, Your Honor, the sick call slip reported bad symptoms, and it was entered into the system as a level one highest priority visit. Everyone in this case agrees that Mr. Madden needed to be seen by the end of the day on October 26th in clinic. He was not only not seen on October 26th, he was not seen on October 27th, and he was not seen by the time he died on October 28th. With respect to the standard that applies, with respect to this specific jail, the medical director and certainly the expert witnesses on both sides have all indicated that the standard would have required him to be seen and evaluated on either October 26th or October 27th. Now, the medical expert testimony in the case concerned what would have been the symptoms that Mr. Madden was experiencing at that time. And it's very clear that he was experiencing congestive heart failure, that fluid would have been building up in his cardiac cavity, that a simple listening to his heart using a simple stethoscope would have sounded an alarm for very serious problems, and that a routine examination could have led to further evaluation that would have ultimately successfully cured him. The medical testimony that we presented, Your Honors, was that if Mr. Madden had gotten down the street to Aurora Sinai Medical Center, right down the street from the Milwaukee County Jail, he could have been started with IV antibiotics, and if necessary, there was plenty of time to perform surgery. Now, the plaintiff's stipulation in this case was that by the time of 1 o'clock in the morning on October 28th, there probably wasn't enough time to do that. In other words, get him down the street to the hospital, have him stabilized, and have surgery performed. However,
so I want to go back to Monell for just a minute. If your Monell theory based on widespread practice, assuming there's no constitutional violation as to any of the individual defendants, and this is back to what I was asking a moment ago and what Judge Kirsch brought up with respect to the Dean case, you have a single incident case, and under our case law, for a widespread practice, if you're pursuing a single incident case, you need to show that widespread practice resulted in constitutional violations in other cases. What proof is in the record to establish that?
Well, one is, Your Honor, that with respect to the Christina Fiebrink death, which happened in August of 2016, she was not even assessed. She was also, like Mr. Madden, experiencing symptoms of opioid
And what's withdrawal. The evidence of that?
It was based on a death review that was conducted.
Is that in the, where does that evidence show up in the record?
It's cited too in the briefs, Your Honor, and it's contained.
Is it in one of the reports or the consent decree?
It's in one of the reports, Your Honor.
One of the expert reports?
One of the reports from Dr. Shansky that was conducted following the review.
How does that come in for the truth of the matter, if that's just in a Dr. Shansky report?
Whether it comes into the
truth. Assuming that's admissible at all, how does that come in for the truth?
Number one, Your Honor, it can come in for the truth of the matter because we presented a litany of evidence to establish that the reports themselves are admissible as regularly conducted activities. The judge did not, the lower court did not address any of the admissibility concerns and disregarded it altogether. Under this court's precedent in the Eisenstadt case, this court is required to assume the admissibility of those reports unless doing so would constitute an abuse of discretion. Now, in the Dean case decided just last year, this court declined to find or hold that the Dr. Shansky's reports were admissible that it would be an abuse of discretion to allow the consideration of Dr. Shansky's reports, and for that reason.
For notice.
Yes.
Not for the truth of the matter.
Correct, Your Honor. But in this case, unlike in the Dean case, which arose out of a facility in Illinois, this case arises out of a facility in Milwaukee that's been under supervision and monitoring by Dr. Shansky for over 20 years. We presented evidence at the lower court for the lower court to consider that Dr. Shansky came at least twice per year for 20 years, that he issued the reports close in time to when he visited, and that there was no objection to any of the reports, even though there was a provision that would have allowed objections and appeals to be taken with respect to any of the reports that he provided. Under an evidentiary standard, Your Honor, we believe there was ample evidence to establish that Dr. Shansky's reports are admissible under the regularly conducted activity standard.
Is that the only evidence you have of the other incidents?
No, Your Honor. I think with respect to Michael Madden's records themselves, they evince on at least four occasions that his sick call slips were not timely responded to as required.
Not Mr. Madden's, with respect to any other incidents. Other than the Shansky report, do you have any other evidence to establish the substantive aspect of these other incidents?
No, other than the Shansky reports and Michael Madden's own charts, we don't have any other evidence in that respect, Your Honor.
Mr. Sorjak, would you mind if I shift you to a different topic?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Okay. What standard of liability governs the claims here? Under the 8th or the 14th Amendment?
The 8th Amendment was what the lower court applied, and we believe under the 8th Amendment standard, particularly with respect to Mercy Mahaga, that the plaintiff presented evidence to establish.
Right. There's no doubt you're right. The district court applied the Eighth Amendment standard. You think that's legally correct, though? The reason I'm asking the question is Mr. Madden came in on a probation violation, right?
Yes.
Was it an alleged violation or an adjudicated determination that he had violated probation?
Yes. It was an alleged violation. I think that there is an issue as to whether the 8th or 14th Amendment.
And why aren't the parties attending to this more? It surprises me that both sides are completely indifferent to this.
The reason why, Your Honor, is we believe that under the 8th Amendment standard that there was sufficient evidence for this matter to be resolved by a jury with respect to Nurse Practitioner Mahaga's specific conduct on her evaluation on October 14th.
But the 14th Amendment might be more favorable to you.
The 14th Amendment might be more favorable, that's true, but we believe that there was sufficient evidence under the 8th Amendment to establish the violation here. And so that's
Can I ask you a further question about that, about the 8th Amendment, the 14th Amendment issue? On Officer Piasecki, you claim that, you know, the individual claims against Officer Piasecki, and if we take the facts as the way you've alleged them, at least in my view, you know, you've got excessive force, right? The question is whether or not it was clearly established at the time, and the district court found that it wasn't. And by my count, you rely on three cases to establish that the law was clearly established. Hudson, which the facts are very different than the facts in this case, and Cyrus versus town of I have the hardest time pronouncing Wisconsin towns, by the way. I don't know what town that is, but I just call the case Cyrus, or Cyrus, and then the next case is Phillips, the Phillips case. But Phillips and Cyrus are both Fourth Amendment cases. There's a problem for you, I think, because you can't take Fourth Amendment cases and apply them to the Eighth Amendment, which I think leaves you with Hudson And of course, the argument that any reasonable officer would have known that this would have been a violation of his constitutional rights under the Eighth Amendment. Is that it? Is there anything else that you can point to on that prong of the test?
No, Your Honor. I believe that's an accurate recitation. In terms of what the Eighth Amendment would require, we do believe that the law would have put Officer Piasecki on notice that the use of any force with respect to an inmate who was actively dying, as Mr. Mannin was at this time, would have been precluded and prohibited by clearly established law at that time. At this time, Your Honor, I see that my time is up, and I'll reserve my remaining 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yeah, of course. Okay, Mr. Hall going to go first? Mr. Hall, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Attorney Sam Hall, and I'll be arguing on behalf of the Milwaukee County appellees. Michael Mannin spent less than 30 days in the Milwaukee County Jail. Over the first 14 days of his time in the jail, he was seen nearly daily by medical providers. That included seeing him through his heroin withdrawal, seeing him through a benzo withdrawal that he took while in the jail. Those withdrawals and the failure to consistently drink water can bring about a wide variety of different symptoms. Those symptoms were evaluated on multiple occasions by medical professionals. It's our position the district court properly concluded that the absence of a constitutional deprivation is fatal to the Monell claim. We really see two issues here as it relates to Monell. First, was there an underlying constitutional deprivation? Was someone deliberately indifferent? The district court answered that question no, and we believe the district court was correct in that. The next issue, and by the way, that's well settled. That goes back to Los Angeles versus Heller with the Supreme Court. That's consistent with this court's rulings in Dean and Donald. The next question is causation. If somebody was deliberately indifferent, can the plaintiff establish that whatever that deliberate indifference was caused the underlying injury? And I think that's what the court was inquiring about as it relates to the holding in Dean. And so here, so much of the focus is on the staffing levels of the medical side of things in the jail, which is happening nationwide. This is not
but
a problem.
Are you, Mr. Hall, you're not arguing that even if none of the individuals here were involved in the constitutional violation, so assume none of the defendants here are liable, that there can't be Monell liability based on widespread practice, are you?
What we're contending is that in the absence of an underlying constitutional deprivation by some official, no Monell claim is viable.
You do agree that a widespread policy or practice that is a motivating factor or motivating force behind a constitutional violation as to Mr. Mannin would be sufficient for Monell liability, even if none of the individual defendants here are liable?
I think there needs to be an underlying constitutional deprivation. And I apologize because I feel like we're maybe ships passing in the night here. But in this case, because it's postured as an Eighth Amendment case, there needs to be a showing of deliberate indifference by some official or by some actor. There has to be a constitutional injury. When you go back to Los Angeles versus Heller, the Supreme Court talks about that, you know, you can have a policy in that case that dealt with use of force. You can have a policy that would allow for unconstitutional use of force, but the Supreme Court literally said it's besides the point.
But our case law has said you can have a widespread practice or a widespread policy, which Monell says, that is the cause of the constitutional violation, even if you don't have any individuals who are identified as liable. We said that in Thomas. We've said that multiple times.
I think conceptually that's right. I think it's certainly in the abstract, but from a practical standpoint, and I guess where I'm going with this is I'm not arguing that an individual defendant that's in the case needs to be found constitutionally responsible in order to open up a Monell claim. I understand that in concept. So there could be some other actor
so
that's
your out argument there. Is that regardless of who did it, any employee, any contractor, nobody violated Mr. Mannin's constitutional rights?
That's correct.
Not the named defendants, not anyone else.
That's correct, and that's what the district court concluded. And that's the primary threshold question. And that's why the district court didn't dig into all of these other issues, because if the court were to answer that question the same way the district court did, the Monell issue is done.
Okay, what about Mr. Surjak's point, though, that the facility has had a long-established practice of problems with the provision of health care, including in some of the very areas that Mr. Madden's case implicated?
So I don't think there's evidence of that. Certainly there is evidence...
Well, cardiac care.
There's certainly evidence of staffing issues. And again, as
and
I said...
Staffing probably contributed to the delinquent or late response to the sick call tickets.
I think that's pure speculation. There were actually fewer sick call... If the court's speaking about the October 25th sick call, the evidence shows that there were actually fewer sick call slips that week than in the prior weeks when they responded relatively quickly. The point to your question, I think, is really touching on causation. So, again, Mr. Madden, this case is not about an inmate who was sitting for weeks waiting for health care, sitting for weeks waiting for a prescription to be filled. And we've seen those cases. That's the Thomas case and it's others. That's not this case. For the first 14 days, he is seen just about daily by medical professionals as he's experiencing symptoms. Now, the estate is essentially trying to fashion a malpractice claim into Section 1983. The estate wants to point the finger at the nurse practitioner and saying, you should have done more, you should have ordered more testing. Those are things that are appropriate for a medical malpractice case, but in a deliberate indifference Section 1983 case, the point is he was seen. The medical providers were there, they evaluated him, and they provided care to him.
Mr. Hall, can I ask you about Officer Pasecki? He's one of your clients here,
right? Yes.
Okay. So it surprised me in your red brief to see you say that even viewing, I'm looking at page 45, okay, even viewing the evidence in the estate's favor, the facts do not support an inference that Pasecki intended to use force in a way that would cause harm to Madden on October 28th. How do you align that with the testimony of the two nurses?
So
I don't see how you can possibly reconcile that.
So fundamentally, when we look at the use of force claim against Pasecki, the estate tries to point to three different things. They point to the use of profanity. They point to Pasecki allegedly lifting Mr. Madden up by his shirt.
Forget that. Go to what Nurse LaTrenta and Adriano testified to.
So in that situation, we have Mr. Madden seated on the ground and allegedly taking the version most favorable to the plaintiff. Mr. Madden is leaning against Pasecki, and the nurses believe that Pasecki purposefully takes a step away from him, causing him to fall to the ground.
And hit his head after he had already fallen and hit his head once.
Correct. Fundamentally, it's not clearly established that that's even a use of force. There is no case law.
So you think the district court got that wrong?
I think there's an open question as to whether that's a use of force.
Wait. Isn't your better argument though that there's no analogous case and that there would be an analogous case required in that situation, that it could be even if it was a use of excessive force?
There is no doubt about it. I mean, this is a qualified immunity.
How do you deal with the U.S. Supreme Court's decisions in Hope v. Peltzer and Taylor versus Riojas? Because you couldn't find a similar case there either.
Sure, but okay, so Hope versus Peltzer involved an Alabama prison inmate who was latched to a hitching post in 90 to 100 degree heat, wasn't provided water. The warden provided a water bucket for his dog right next to the
They argued there's no similar case, and the Supreme Court said forget it.
I understand that, but that seems to be a very, very different fact pattern, and how egregious and clearly egregious that was compared to somebody who allegedly takes a step away from an individual who's seated on the floor. No one's even claiming that Mr. Madden fell from a standing position. At this point, he's seated on the floor, and the allegation is that Pasecki steps away. And again,
well, it was a little bit more than that. It was that he moved intentionally so he would fall after he'd already hit his head once.
That is the allegation.
Not just innocently stepped away.
You say allegation. There's testimony right? It's more than just people alleging that, okay? Let me give you the answer that Nurse LaTrenta provided in her deposition. I'm reading it right to you. Once Officer Pasecki had assisted Madden over the door as he waited for the wheelchair, he purposely allowed him not once but twice to fall and hit his head. Right, this is somebody that watched it happen. It's not just some allegation. You know, we don't know whether it happened or not.
No, and on the summary judgment review, the facts have to be taken in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, and we accept that. That's why, I mean, certainly the strongest argument is qualified immunity. And that's why it's really important that this is being treated as an Eighth Amendment case.
Let me give you a hypothetical. Suppose that there were two correctional officers that were helping an inmate out of a cell, kind of like you'd help an injured athlete off a field. You know what I mean? Where you kind of put your arm around the shoulder and you help him out. And one of the officers says to another, let's drop him. Let's drop him. And they do it, pounds his head on the concrete. And they lift him up, and they're walking him a few more feet, and they say, drop him again. Can't find a case says you can't do that. You can search the Federal Reporter, search the U.S. reports. You're not going to find a similar case. Is that a problem? How do you evaluate that hypothetical?
It is a case where qualified immunity ought to apply because the exception that the court notes, the Hope versus Pelzer exception, is applied exceedingly rare. And Hope versus Pelzer
just applied it last year in Taylor.
Was a horrible case.
What about Taylor versus Riojas? Can't find a case that having an inmate live in his own waste and sewage violates the Constitution. The court said, of course you can't. It's obvious.
Your Honor, I think it's a qualified immunity case. It is also a de minimis use of force. Mr. Madden was subject to an autopsy. There's no claim of a head injury. There was no head injury found. There was no contusion, nothing like that. And so, again, I think I'm not here to argue with the court as to whether or not it as a matter of law violates the Eighth Amendment or doesn't.
No, you make a good point on there's a damage issue here because unfortunately this fellow was, it looks like the heart issue was going to take his life.
But the Eighth Amendment also, unlike the 14th and 4th Amendment, contemplates de minimis use of force. And in cases involving Eighth Amendment uses of force, when there isn't injury, some would even say significant injury, those are traditionally not actionable under the Eighth Amendment. And again, Mr. Madden was subject to an autopsy. With that, I respectfully request the court to affirm. Thank you.
Very well. Okay. Mr. Reardon?
Good morning. May it please the court. I represent Armor Correctional Health, Nurse Adriano, and Nurse Practitioner Mahaga. I think Attorney Hall was correct in saying that this is a medical malpractice case. This is not a 1983 action case. The arguments by plaintiff's counsel rely solely on their expert's testimony. There is no evidence to infer that Nurse Mahaga knew or inferred that Michael Madden had infective endocarditis. And we know from the case law that an expert's testimony regarding unreasonable treatment does not equate to conscious disregard. So you can't make the leap from this expert testimony to Nurse Mahaga having conscious disregard for the health care of Mr. Madden. In fact, on October 14th, Mr. Madden came in, complained of diarrhea, not tolerating jail diet, and unable to sleep. There was no complaints of chest pain, no complaints of fever, no complaints of chill, fatigue, or joint ache. All of the elements allegedly of infective endocarditis. And I think what is really telling is that the plaintiff is not suing Nurse Adriano for deliberate indifference when in fact she did find chest pain and fever. I don't know how you can say one individual was deliberately indifferent with regard to the care of the same individual the next day when the symptoms were more severe or on point the day previously. And I think that also undercuts any Monell claim because there's no pattern. There's no pattern or custom if, in fact, you say that Nurse Adriano is not deliberately indifferent, but Nurse Mahaga is. That doesn't make any sense. Also, with regard, I think, to the October 25th claim regarding the allergy, in the electronic record, it indicates that Mr. Madden said, I have severe allergies. My prescriptions are old. I need a new prescription for my allergies. There was no complaint of chest pain, no complaint of fever, no complaint of any type of element that you would associate with infective endocarditis.
What about the argument that if they had seen him on that, given the increasing severity of his heart condition, that they would have identified it and treated it?
Again, I think that's speculative. And two, you're relying on an expert's testimony that is rebutted by another expert.
Is that enough to get an issue of fact?
I don't think with regard to a deliberate indifference, no. Maybe to medical malpractice, but not to deliberate indifference. In this particular case, you have a series of individuals evaluating the same patient that came up with a diagnosis or finding of dehydration. And there are facts to support dehydration. He was not drinking. He had diarrhea. He was not eating. In fact, on October 11th, when he came in with the same symptoms, they applied some solution, they gave him some fluids, and he bounced back. He comes in on the 13th with the same complaints. He has chest pain, but however, he indicates to Nurse Adriano that he has GERDs, which causes chest pain. And the chest pain is not steady. It's indicated that it's intermittent. It's not strong, but it's sharp at times, which is very symptomatic or very similar to complaints of GERD. So what we're arguing here is actually a medical malpractice case. Did they come up with the right diagnosis? Not whether they were deliberately indifferent, because they did treat this individual. They looked into his symptoms. They assessed him. They took information from him in order to determine what the problem was.
Mr. Reardon, set aside the way the case has been litigated for a second. I know that's a big ask.
That's okay. I got in the middle of this one, so I can set it aside easily.
All right. Set it aside and set aside the district court opinion.
Okay.
What's the proper legal standard? 14th Amendment, objective unreasonableness, or 8th Amendment deliberate indifference?
I think
what's the proper legal analysis of that?
I think with regard to Mercy Mahaga's 8th Amendment. And in fact,
No. Shouldn't turn upon a defendant, right? It's going to turn upon the 1983 plaintiff here, right?
Correct.
Right. Whether he's, been convicted, serving a sentence, or whether he's a pretrial detainee. And the oddity of this case is that it's this probation violation.
I think the case.
And the reason I'm asking you this, and the reason I interrupted you.
I'm sorry.
I should apologize, not you. The reason I asked you that is when you're saying it's not deliberate indifference, it looks more like, medical malpractice. Well, the moment that we change the legal framework and we say, let's analyze it under pretrial detainee 14th Amendment standards, right? That doesn't help your client. That hurts your client, arguably.
It makes it easier, I think, for the plaintiff to
right.
prove.
Right. Mr. Sergek's case gets better.
But it doesn't take it out of medical malpractice.
Fair. Right. No, that's right. They're not one and the same there. What do you think the right answer to this is? It's difficult when we get the briefs, we see the district court opinion. It's just a foregone conclusion that it's Eighth Amendment, apparently. It's not that clear to me.
I don't disagree with you that it's kind of a foregone conclusion that it's Eighth Amendment. However, in this instance, I believe that issue regarding the 14th Amendment was waived. But given the fact that it's being discussed, I think the fact, the circumstances involved here, as I think Attorney Sergic has indicated, kind of lead it to an Eighth Amendment claim.
Why is that? Because in Miranda, we said in 2018, Miranda versus County of Lake, that pretrial detainees received 14th Amendment consideration, not Eighth Amendment, for medical issues. And the question is Mr. Madden considered a pretrial detainee here when he is brought in on a probation violation that hasn't been adjudicated yet?
I think that is a tricky question. I don't think he is.
Why?
I think if, in fact, he's a pretrial detainee, he's not in the situation he is. There is more, you don't essentially slap somebody in jail as a pretrial detainee and keep them there for that amount of time.
That's not true. You may.
Certain circumstances, but in this circumstance,
there are many defendants who, while awaiting trial, are in jail for a long time.
I think in this circumstance, though, we have a parole violation in which
that hasn't been adjudicated.
I'm kind of a loss for words. I don't think I don't think Madden actually forced the issue regarding whether he was a pretrial detainee or not. I think that they almost gave it up. Yeah. So I think that's why we're stuck here with the Eighth Amendment.
No, I know. I mean, look, we're trying to solve something. I don't know that's solvable. I mean, a case hasn't been litigated this way at all.
It hasn't. So for me to
go... And to be fair, I don't know that our law is clear on this situation. When somebody's picked up on a parole violation, do you consider them a pretrial detainee versus convicted on the other underlying conviction?
I think the case law is split. So I think that you can go either way, but I think in this particular instance, it has been tried and prosecuted as an Eighth Amendment case.
There's a backdrop principle to this too, and that is that people can waive constitutional rights. May not be a good idea.
I would agree with that as well.
You can do it. Most.
So that's an issue for brighter minds than mine as to where that line is drawn. But I think in this particular case, the line has been drawn, and it's the Eighth Amendment in this particular case.
Because of waiver.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Mr. Sergic. Got 5 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. And with respect to the issue that we were just discussing most recently, I agree that we did say, even applying the Eighth Amendment standard, that there's a constitutional violation, but that's because we've always looked at this as so much more than a medical malpractice case, Your Honors. And the reason why counsel...
You didn't say even applying. You said the Eighth Amendment should apply.
I believe in a footnote in the lower court, we said even applying the Eighth Amendment standard.
But you never advocated for the 14th Amendment standard, at least from what... Unless I'm missing something, please tell me if I'm missing something.
That's true, because we believe under any view of the evidence under the Eighth Amendment standard, there was sufficient evidence for this to be decided by a jury. Now, what counsel is raising is this Nurse Adriano visit on October 13th. Now, of course, on October 13th, Nurse Adriano notes chest pain, and she notes that Mr. Mann is experiencing a fever. What she does to prove that she was not deliberately indifferent, she's only a registered nurse. She's not a provider. She's not an advanced level provider. So she schedules a visit with the advanced level provider, who's Mercy Mahaga. And so Mr. Mannion goes to Mercy Mahaga for an evaluation on October 14th.
Mr. Sergic, can I ask you a question? Even if she misdiagnosed him, it still is probably not deliberate indifference here. But let me ask you a question. I'm much more interested in Mr. Piasecki or Officer Piasecki. And my question is this. If there is no analogous case under the Eighth Amendment, and we find here that there's a constitutional duty to prop. By the way, I watched the video. The elevator video is very hard to watch. What happened to Mr. Madden, there's no dispute, is terrible. It's horrible. It's tragic. But if we find that there's a constitutional duty to prop up an ailing prisoner, a guard has a constitutional duty not to not drop someone, but to actually prop somebody up. What limit can we impose upon that? Hope says it's very limited where we say there's no analogous case, and Taylor says that there's a cell and an individual covered with feces, and it's so obvious that you can't have that. Is this one of those cases? And if it is, what's the limit that we impose upon prisoner guards that you have to prop this person up but not this person? You have to assist this person but not this person. How do we write it?
Yes, the requirement that the plaintiff is asking for is not a duty to prop up. It's a duty or responsibility not to maliciously and sadistically cause harm. Now, when he's seated, Mr.
Well,
Madden
then you would establish,
seated.
But that's not the testimony. The testimony is that he's seated. He's leaning up against Officer Piasecki's legs, and Officer Piasecki moves, which causes him to hit his head on the floor, right? Except if we accept the testimony, that's the testimony. I know that's disputed, and if it goes to trial, you may win or lose on that. I don't know. But I think that's the testimony, that he's Piasecki has the Mr. Madden leaning up against him. Piasecki moves, and Mr. Madden falls from a seated position and hits his head on the floor.
Yes, but it needs to be in the context that he was transporting Mr. Madden and let him go before, causing Mr. Madden to smash his head on the wall. So after Mr. Madden smashed his head on the wall, Officer Piasecki propped Mr. Madden up on his legs at the same time that he was screaming at him, calling him a piece of shit and to get the fuck up, and then he removed his legs. Now, in terms of excessively and sadistically causing harm, we believe the facts fit right into the analysis of Eighth Amendment cases. More specifically, as we cited in the brief, the use of force in a situation where someone's actively dying and it was apparent that this man was actively dying, every officer would have been on notice of that based on the law in this circuit that already existed. Now, turning, I only have a minute left, but with respect to Nurse Practitioner Mahaga and this court's existing case law on the deliberate indifference claim by a healthcare provider, we're entitled to present circumstantial evidence that Nurse Practitioner Mahaga did know of the risk of infective endocarditis to Mr. Madden. That's very clear in the Petty's case that this court previously decided. And we know that at the time that Nurse Practitioner Mahaga evaluated Mr. Madden on October 14th, two medical emergencies in the past 3 days had been called for this man's chest pain, that he was evaluated by Nurse Practitioner Mahaga with respect to the chest pain that he was experiencing. Now, she says she doesn't know what a common medical abbreviation, CP, meant, that she didn't ask anybody about what that meant. She didn't ask Mr. Madden. She didn't know anything about it. She didn't review his records. Under this court's law, if she's not acting as a healthcare provider would act in these circumstances, and she's acting in a blatantly inappropriate fashion, that's enough to create circumstantial evidence of deliberate indifference. That's what we believe exists here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, very well. Mr. Sorjak, thank you. Mr. Hall, Mr. Reardon, thank you. The case will be taken under advisement.